We made this.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, for this special episode, moving away from our normal episode coverage of the show to discuss, for the first discussion of many, to discuss the comics of the X-Files comics of Stefan Petrucha and Charlie Adlard and various assorted others from the 1990s, the mid-1990s, the Topps comics. And we're going to start going through them systematically from beginning to end. And this is going to be a great fun project that I'm very happy to be doing with your friend and mine, X-Cast regular extraordinaire, Darren Mooney. How are you, Darren?
I'm good. And I want to assure listeners I am not holding a gun to Tony's head when he says this. Yeah, no, this is a delight. Like, this is one of the things where Tony, like, texts me and he's like, would you be interested in this? And I was like, Yes, I would. No, thank you for inviting me on. I'm always thrilled to be on the X-Cast. It's always fun to be talking about the X-Files, but in particular, these are a part of X-Files lore or mythos or apocrypha that I have always had a huge soft spot for. So I am absolutely thrilled to get a chance to talk about them and maybe bring them to light. And maybe, you know, hopefully some listeners who have kind of like accidentally clicked on this episode while waiting for something more related to the show or something on something else are like, actually, yeah, this sounds kind of interesting. I might give those a go because, yeah, I'm always glad to get the word out there. They're largely forgotten and largely kind of underappreciated, I think, as far as X-Files paraphernalia goes. But I think I'm thrilled to be talking about them.
Well, there was no one else to do this, particularly because we should start by pointing people to your reviews of them, for one thing, on your site, the movie blog, moviewithazero.com. And you've, I'm right in thinking, aren't I, that you went through all of them some years ago and you've, in text basis, as a written review, done all of these comics.
Yes. So what happened is basically I did the first season of the X-Files as a kind of a project, I think for one anniversary. I can't remember whether it was the 20th or the 25th or whatever, but I did it and people seemed to like it and it garnered some attention. And then the X-Files files, the Kumail Nanjiani's wonderful kind of other competing podcast, not as prolific as this one, but another X-Files podcast, mentioned them and started drawing people's attention to them and people started reading them more. And they were like, would you like consider going on and doing like other X-Files reviews? And I was like, yeah, I kind of would, but you know what, I'm only going to do it in the most completely insane, unsustainable, push me to a mental breakdown kind of way I can possibly imagine. I don't want to just review the X-Files. I don't want to go from beginning to end. I don't want to chart the 9-year journey of the show. I want to take a look at the whole X-Files experience. I want to step back and I want to cover pretty much everything that I can find relating to the phenomenon of the X-Files, particularly in that original run in the 90s. So I went out of my way and I did things like later on, I would obviously do all the spin-offs. I did Millennium, I did The Lone Gunman, I did Harsh Realm, I did that sort of stuff. I did special entries on things like, you know, the Springfield Files or kind of, you know, the Mulder and Scully by Catatonia and things like that in order to position the X-Files in terms of culture. I played both video games and reviewed both video games as well to get a sense of those and what they meant and what they were doing and where they were at. And yes, I kind of, as I went along, I took a look at kind of the X-Files tie-in comics as they go, starting obviously with the ones that we're talking about today, which are the ones first released by Topps in January 1995, but continuing sporadically throughout the show's run. So this one runs for, I think, about 41 issues, which is reasonably long as these sorts of tie-in comic book runs go. It shifts direction several times over the course of the run. A very brief introduction, the first 12 issues are essentially one gigantic arc. Now, that arc has smaller sub-stories within them. We're kind of breaking down, we're going by sub-story. So I think today we're going to talk about the first three issues, which are essentially three standalone issues. But then after that, there's another three-part story, and all of the first 12 issues kind of fit together and tell an overarching story. Then for like four issues, Stefan Petrucca, kind of, you get a sense that he's been told by management, don't do that again. So he's like, okay, fine, I will continue doing standalone stories in, like, in the X-Files mold. And then they kind of shift and you get, like, he's replaced as writer and they replace Charles Adlard as artist. And you get a kind of a different direction for the remainder of the 41-issue run. And then, obviously, Topps' license expires. They stop publishing the comics that, as a result of, like, the larger force in the comic book industry, they contract. But then, you know, over the course of the show's run, it comes back. It comes back as, say, Wildstorm Comics, I think, during the kind of gap around the time that you started seeing I Want to Believe. When I Want to Believe came out, I think you get like Wildstorm doing a series which is co-written by Frank Spotnitz. It's at least the first couple of issues of it. And then you see a different approach to how you write tie-in comics. And then obviously more recently, the big one was the IDW range, which recently reprinted these. And actually, if you are interested in reading these comics, IDW have actually done a really good job of making the archives available. They're available in hardcover collections, softcover collections, and you can just buy them digitally as well if you want to. If you want to kind of delve in and get a sense of what we're talking about today. But IDW then obviously also, and we talked a little bit, we did a coverage for Millennium. We covered like the tie-in issues within the X-Files comic there, Joe Harris's comic, and also his Millennium miniseries. But that exists like at a different point in fan culture completely, where comic books are now kind of continuing the narrative of the show rather than like supplementing it or retreading it. So like one of the things I really loved about doing that project, covering the X-Files from beginning to what was at the time the end, was not only just the show itself, but the ancillary media and how those elements of the show, be they video games, be they tie-in novels, be they comic books, how they relate to the original core text and kind of what they do with the inspiration they take from it and how they adapt that into different media. So yeah, that's kind of like what I decided to do as a complete madman. I do not think I will do that again ever for anything because it is completely bonkers. But I am incredibly proud that I did it. And it's something, like again, And I say proud as it, you know, like it's like one of those great accomplishments. Like when I die, I want people to be like, yeah, he reviewed all the Topps X-Files comics. But I am proud of myself that I committed to the bit and I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really interesting way for me to experience the show and go back to a show that I loved and kind of like dig into it in a way that taught me new things about it, I think, I would hope. And obviously I found a host of really great stuff. Like to preface our discussion here, those opening 16 issues, written by Stefan Petrucca and largely illustrated by Charles Adlard, are, to me, probably the best tie-in comic books I have ever read, or my personal favorite tie-in comic books I have ever read. They are a staggering accomplishment. They're one of my favorite pieces of X-Files. You know, I'm not even going to say ancillary media. Let's say media in general associated with the X-Files. They're very, like, I've read my share of tie-in comics covering stuff like Star Wars, Star Trek, and so on and so forth. This stuff towers over it, and I'm kind of really, like, I genuinely was thrilled when you asked, would you like to do this? And there was no way I was ever going to say no. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
No, thanks, Darren, because I'm completely, in some ways, the opposite in that I'm new. I'm new to the comic side of things. So I'm kind of just getting into comics generally, if I'm honest. I'm starting to go through a lot of the Marvel stuff. It's something that I'm starting to tap into. And this is, I've always been curious about them. You know, your interview with Stefan Petrucca on the podcast a few years ago was fantastic and it was really interesting. And I'd encourage anyone to go back into the archives and find that. But I've never got around to it. And I've since bought the hardbacks, where it collects all of the issues, and they are beautiful. Like you said, they're a great collection for these.
Listeners may want to get their ears ready. That is the sound of me knocking my two hardcover copies together because I got notes.
Very good. Very good. Well, I say I've got all of them. I've got the first one right now only digitally because I couldn't quite get that at the time. Yeah. But I've got the other three, and I'm going to get the first one in hardback, so I've got a proper collection because they are beautiful. They're not cheap anymore, but they're beautiful. So they're well worth the money. So I'm sort of starting at first principles with this. I'm coming at this as a newbie experiencing these for the first time. So what we should have during this run of things is a nice back and forth between the person who's gone through them, who knows the broader context, who knows the ultimate overarching storyline, and, you know, Mr. Newbie. It's almost like, Darren, when you get someone on an X-Files, on the X-Cast podcast, talking about the X-Files when they're new to the show and they're going through it for the first time. I almost feel like I'm getting to experience the X-Files for the first time in comic form in the same way. So it's quite fun for me.
And I've been sitting down in the X-Files comic basement, you know, all these years. And you know, all of a sudden you just walk in the door and you've been sent to debunk my work, you know?
Oh, there you go, yeah. I'm the comic Scully. Yeah, there are worse fates. So yeah, I would definitely say at the outset, go to Darren's website. We'll put links actually in the show notes for this as well, so people can access Darren's, obviously the broad collection of Darren's X-Files work, which is fantastic, but for these comics as well, the comic reviews, so that'll be a nice additional medium for you to look at. But we're going to start, and like you said earlier, we're going to go through the first three issues, because it starts with an opening one solo story, but as you say, there's an overarching sort of arc to it, and then the second story is a sort of loose two-parter in many ways, connecting together. So it'll be interesting to do this and see what we come up with. So let's dive right in then. So the first one is obviously written by Stephen Petrucca, drawn by Charlie Adlard, and this first one is called Not to Be Opened Until X Dashmas.
And let's be honest, I was on board from literally page one with this sort of thing, to be clear. Like there's a couple of, like, Petrucca has some really, really, really great titles. Like coming up, for example, you have Trepanning Opera, which is one of my favorite titles of anything ever. But you also have like Tiptoeing Through the Tulpas as well, which is another one. And again, like you mentioned, I did an interview with Petrucca. I think I pitched you on that. I think I was like, I would love to pick this guy's brains, because it's a fascinating, fascinating kind of discussion. And I would recommend that. It's a very interesting bit of context for the somewhat troubled and perhaps, you know, awkward genesis and development of this series, which we'll inevitably get into when we talk about the comics. Before we jump in, first thing to note, actually, just to give a sense of kind of context to the X-Files comic. Why was there an X-Files comic? And if you look at the first cover of, like, Do Not Open Until Xmas, the front cover of it, you will see why immediately. Underneath the big number one and the $2.50 US or $3.40 Canadian, there's the first collector's item issue kind of header there, which is an important bit of context in terms of, like, why we have an X-Files comic. Why comic books were a medium that the X-Files wanted to do at the time, when they were emerging as, like, one of the hot properties, particularly a hot property for teenagers at the time. The comic book industry is a very interesting, very storied history. I won't get too much into the weeds here, but it should be noted that, you know, initially they were seen as being a very cheap, very disposable medium, mostly for kids, occasionally given to like soldiers going off to fight in the Second World War, largely seen as being disposable, printed on cheap paper, not meant to last. That's why like there's all these big things about restoring classic comic books, and there's some wonderful articles in there if you want to Google them. But what happened is, in the 80s, we kind of saw a shift in how comics were sold. They started going away from being sold in drugstores or newsagents. I mean, today you won't see that many comic books available in newsagents or, you know, as singles in grocery stores. Like they used to be on racks, like you'll see in old classic movies or whatever from people who remember that era. They shifted to a direct market model. They started being things that were sold in specialty stores. And as part of that, you started seeing the emergence of a speculation boom. You started seeing these things being sold and being turned into events. Arguably, you could say comparable to how movies are kind of treated as blockbuster events, where it's like you have to see it on opening weekend, except kind of on steroids, as it were. And towards the end of the 80s, you had this kind of huge push towards making comic books into this gigantic money-making industry. What had been a disposable industry was suddenly turned into a lucrative market. So you had like a number of auctions where like classic comics, like say Action Comics number one or Detective Comics number 27 would be sold at ridiculously high prices because they were rare, because the only surviving suitable copies were, you know, not that common. So you started seeing this boom in speculation, the idea that you would buy these comics, you would put them in bags, and then presumably like 25 years later, your kids would retire for life on selling this copy of like X-Files number one or Bloodsport number one that you bought. And so like you had kind of like, and you had at the time this idea of, you know, rebranding big events. So comics had traditionally run for years and years and years. Like Superman had run since, I think, like 1938, Batman since 1940 or whatever. And so you had like comic books that were around about like issue number 207, issue number 344. But you started seeing towards the end of the 80s pushes towards new number ones. So like Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man number one became the biggest selling comic book of all time in the late 80s. And then a couple of years later, Jim Lee and Chris Claremont's X-Men number one became the biggest comic of all time, selling 8 million copies. In 1992, DC Comics came up with, 8 million. That's a stunning figure. And in terms of like, then you get to the whole Death of Superman stuff, which listeners may or may not be aware of, but it was like this big event, Superman's going to die. You're going to buy this comic. It's going to come in a black bag, a black sealed bag, so that like in 25 years, you can sell it on and it will be in mint condition because no air has touched it. And it just becomes this kind of spiral of kind of people buying speculatively. And, you know, long term, it is not healthy for the industry. It causes a massive implosion when people realize that if you're selling 8 million copies of X-Men number one inside plastic bags, then, you know, in 25 years time, there's going to be no shortage of copies of X-Men number one. But it does mean that you start seeing companies looking at that market and going, can we have a piece of it? And so you have this big explosion in the 90s of kind of minor comic book companies, companies that are not, say, DC or Marvel. Companies like, say, Malibu, for example, companies like Boom and Image, I think, are two that have actually managed to sustain themselves. And you see companies like Topps getting into the market. And Topps are, for those who are not familiar with the American marketplace, primarily known as a trading card company. I think they do like baseball trading cards, but like fans of science fiction will probably know them for the Mars Attacks range of trading cards from the late 60s. And they decide they're going to break into comic book publishing. And they say, okay, let's get ourselves some licenses. Let's publish some comics that we think that young people will want to read. And what happens is, you see this move in the 90s where these young publishers eagerly snap up licensed properties, like, say, Star Trek, for example, or Star Wars. And they say, we will pay the studios massive amounts of money for the licensing rights to this to print them. Because, and the reason for that, you see minor publishers doing it, companies like Topps or, say, Malibu doing it with Deep Space Nine, is because big companies like DC and Marvel generally have their own in-house characters. They aren't interested in spending large sums of money to license properties from other companies in order to publish material that they can't then, you know, repackage later on when the license runs out. Famously, like, Marvel had some difficulty with that in the 80s with characters like Rom Space Knight, where they would publish these comics and then the license would move on and Marvel would no longer own the rights to those comics or the characters in those comics, and that would be an issue. So DC and Marvel tended to stay away from licensing properties like that because they couldn't fold them into the larger business plan. And so you end up seeing smaller publishers paying greater sums of money in order to print X-Files comics. So, well, not X-Files comics, but like licensed comics in general. And Topps picked up the X-Files brand. And again, just in terms of context, there's always seems to have been an awkward relationship between the X-Files office, Chris Carter and the creative team, and the comic book publishers. In particular, like, and again, this is not something that is unique to X-Files comics. It's quite common in licensed comic book properties. Famously at DC Comics, when they were publishing Star Trek, writers like, say, Peter David would talk about the difficulty in getting their scripts past people like Richard Arnold, who was Gene Roddenberry's right-hand man, because they had very, like, fixed ideas about protecting the brand and what the brand was supposed to be. In fact, I think the original plan was for Peter David, who had done work on Star Trek at DC, to come over and write the X-Files comic. I think he knew David Nutter, and David Nutter had actually pitched, had suggested that Peter David come in and pitch an episode for the first or second season of the show. And they said, no, we're not really interested in that, but would you like to write the comic? And Peter David said, no, I have enough trouble getting my Star Trek scripts approved. Thank you very much. So Petrucca ended up being the kind of second choice. So that kind of gives a sense of like how tumultuously the relationship existed there. I think like at the time, Carter was giving interviews where he was talking about how uncomfortable he felt with the X-Files blowing up and becoming a brand. It's the one of the interviews where he refers to wampum, the idea of like walking in and seeing David Duchovny's face on underwear, X-Files branded underwear, and talking about how uncomfortable he felt when he was like going to like big VHS stores and finding VHS copies of X-Files on the shelves there. And I think at one point he said, like, you know, I actually think the X-Files would be a much cooler thing if those VHS copies were only available to buy in a single, like, Van Nuys surf shop, you know, or a head shop, that sort of stuff, whereas a bit kind of more elitist or cool or hip, you know, worried about selling out or being seen as selling out. So there was always this kind of tension about like what the X-Files was going to be as it became a mass market kind of property. And in terms of kind of like situating this in terms of where the show was, this was January 1995. So this was roughly midway through the second season. And there is an oblique reference to that early in the first issue where Scully talks about how she missed Mulder's slideshows. And from that, I think we're supposed to infer that this is shortly after her return in One Breath. This is perhaps the first or second case that she's done after coming back in One Breath. But yeah, so this is early second season. It's not quite third season. It's not a huge international breakout hit yet, but it's on the verge of being. And there's a bit of back and forth happening right now about what The X-Files is going to look like when it moves from being like a quirky show on Fox on Friday nights to an internationally recognizable brand or property.
That's a fantastic bit of context because it places the position of these comics, as you say, the start of January 1995. And, you know, as I was reading them, I was thinking, where does this fit in terms of the canon of the show, if you like? And I think there's a comment Mulder makes in one of these issues about how Deep Throat has gone. So it's definitely is within the second season. And that was my instinct that it was roughly in line with the show. This wouldn't be considered canon, though, would it, in any way?
No, absolutely not. And one of the big things, one of the things you see as it goes on, and actually, like, we'll be talking about it in when we talk about these first three issues, is you can see that Petrucca kind of initially begins testing the waters to figure out where he can fit it in canon. So early on in the run, you see appearances from characters like Skinner and the cigarette-smoking man. But again, you got to keep in mind, and again, from talking to Petrucca, these scripts were written 6 months before they were published. So you have to keep in mind that this was written like back at the very start of the second season airing. So this was before like One Breath had aired. So this was before you had characterization of Skinner or the cigarette smoking man as we would come to know them. He was just basing them off the two characters who had appeared in Tombs, for example. So like when you're reading them, those characters can seem off. And what happens very, very quickly is Petrucca discovers, from dealing with the X-Files office, from dealing with the people at 1013, that it is just a lot easier if instead of using supporting characters that people will recognize, like the cigarette-smoking man or like Skinner, he makes up his own that kind of fulfills similar functions. I think, like, I talked to him on Twitter when I was reviewing these, and I think he made the point that, like, one of the informants was originally meant to be, like, Mr. X or the cigarette-smoking man, but he just had so much trouble dealing with, like, getting the scripts approved with those characters in them that he just said, you know what, just make it another guy. Make it a new character, and then that'll kind of work. And, like, again, as we develop, and it's probably interesting to see this now, one of the things that I think makes Petrucca's run fascinating is that you see him branch off. He realizes very quickly he can't necessarily tell a mythology story in a way that fits with the mythology of the show itself, because that mythology is still being defined. And like to give an example, and again, not to jump too far ahead into the discussion that we're going to have, A Little Dream of Me, the third and final issue we'll be covering in this episode, is focused very heavily on the relationship between Fox and Samantha Mulder. That comic is released in March 1995, which is the same month that you get Colony and Endgame, which radically redefine like Samantha's role in the larger mythology, and which, if you're reading this in real time with the show, makes you go, huh, what's going on here and how do they relate to one another? And I think it's interesting, particularly reading these early issues, to see Petrucca kind of figuring it out. Later on, he just goes, you know what? It's my own ball. I'm just going to go in my own direction with it. But in the first three issues, certainly you have that interesting idea of him saying, can I make this fit? Is it possible with the competing scheduling of a TV show where they're shooting week on week and a comic book where I have to script 6 months in advance? And it doesn't really work, but it gives it this kind of interesting friction. And I think it plays into, like, not to delve too much into the content of what he's doing, but like one of the big themes of Petrucca's run is the notion of reality and the question of what is real and what is false and how we perceive reality and whether there are multiple realities and what is truth. You know, the truth is out there, but what if there are multiple truths, which is, you know, again, it's a very clever, winky, metafictional kind of way of kind of working around the fact that he's a comic book writer working in a medium where he will always be 6 months behind what's happening on television, working with a production team who very understandably are not treating his work as a priority when they're like doing their own. So I think you have that kind of interesting tension there. And I think Petrucca does a better job balancing that than most. I think he does a better job than some of the people who follow him on the comic without casting too much shade. I think that's an interesting part of it.
Yeah, and I think reading this as a first timer, you do get the sense that Petrucca very much has his own style, his own approach to the X-Files, without it being not the X-Files. He has a particular style of how he writes these stories that fits while also being quite unique, individual. So Not to Be Opened Until Xmas is a great example of where, and this is a one-shot story, this is a singular issue, of where he takes a real-life slice of mythology, of arcanum, of strangeness, and he weaves it into an X-File. Now, what we're going to do, just to preface this, we're not going to necessarily go through it page by page or anything like that, but we're going to talk generally about the themes, the ideas, things in the story. So what I would suggest, really, is if you haven't read these, I would find a way to go and do it before you carry on, realistically. So I think you'll get more out of the analysis if you've read them, you know, in the first. So that's a spoiler warning, I guess. Not that we really need to put a spoiler warning on something that's 25 years old, but for your own enjoyment, maybe approach it this way. But Not to Be Opened Until Xmas is not a story necessarily about Christmas, you might be surprised to find out, but it is based on the mystery of the Fatima prophecies. Now this is something I hadn't actually come across, Darren, before. I won't lie, this was quite new to me. And then after this, I went a bit down a bit of a Google rabbit hole. And the essence is that Mulder and Scully investigate the death of a John Doe who crashes through the window of a church after you're covered in blood, after speaking to a priest, and it ultimately leads them onto the trail of the third mysterious Fatima prophecy, which was based on a genuine event that happened in 1917. It was a Portuguese trio of siblings who had a vision of what could be the Virgin Mary or a visitation anyway, that gave them these religious prophecies, two of which were released and put out there, and the third one was locked up and sealed by the Vatican. And there was an ongoing mystery as to what was in this third prophecy, with a Pope at the time opening it up in 1960 and saying this isn't basically for now, this is for the future, and it got locked up. Was actually released in 2000. So after this story, actually, the third prophecy was released, but there is some controversy as to whether it was the real thing. So there is still a bit of a mystery about the potentially that this prophecy was about the end times, the end of days, and the Vatican are keeping a lid on it. So that's the general thrust of the core story. And then Mulder and Scully get involved, and it becomes a little bit of a murder mystery or a mystery of a death that then leads Mulder towards a truth that blends the Fatima prophecies, I guess, with ufology and the possibility of alien lore, which in itself, Darren, is a very sort of X-Files-y kind of thing, isn't it? Trying to wedge together these two different things.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, one of the things that you'll notice as you read through this run of comic books is that in many ways, Petrucca ends up being slightly ahead and to the left, or, you know, rather than back and to the left, he's forward and to the left of kind of where the show ends up going, where it's like, and again, part of it's probably down to the fact that if you are doing a show about like conspiracy theories, you're inevitably going to be drawn to things like, well, was Jesus an extraterrestrial? You know, is religion something that came to us from outer space? Or, you know, like later on, to pick an example, you know, a memory and reality and how those things blur together, or like the Tunguska event, which is a massive part of like a story in this initial year run, and then like 2 years later the show puts its own unique spin on the Tunguska event as well. So like there's very much a sense that he's operating on a similar wavelength and playing with similar ideas. And I mean, like, again, it's worth noting that, you know, this is during the second season of the X-Files, so we haven't quite hit the point. It's, you know, we're a couple of months away from, you know, things where kind of Carter starts going really heavily into the idea of kind of like blending religions and aliens in things like, you know, Fearful Symmetry, for example, you know, where it's like, are the aliens building an ark, for example, that sort of thing. And, you know, later on where you have, you know, the mythology and Anasazi, for example, but arguably, you know, obviously then the kind of bridging of the six and seven seasons with Biogenesis and Amor Fati, and obviously in the ninth season, Provenance and Providence, where Carter kind of goes wholeheartedly on that. And again, you can see that Petrucca's working from a very rough version of this, where Scully is, he knows Scully's a Catholic, but she's lapsed rather than like actually practicing sort of stuff, which is interesting. It feels like you can tell that these are characters that are not necessarily fully formed, because again, he's just writing them off the back of the first season, or the first season, a couple episodes of the second one. So he hasn't entirely figured out how they fit together. But you can see that he's understanding like what the core ideas of the X-Files are or will be. And I think, yeah, the fact that he goes big on faith in the opening, in this opening story is quite telling, quite interesting, and again does prefigure directions the show itself will go. And it actually, like you mentioned, the reveal of the prophecy in 2000, it was the reveal that, like, of a previous attempt on the life of Pope John Paul II, if I remember correctly. That's what that was was officially released, if I remember correctly.
I think
one of the big arguments, which I find fascinating, is that the church only released that third prophecy in the year 2000 because they wanted to head off like conspiratorial fear mongering about this idea of the rapture or the biblical apocalypse or something like that, which I find amazing, that like the idea that the Catholic Church had to like disavow. They're like, no, don't worry. Third prophecy already happened. Nothing to worry about. Nothing to see here. Just kind of forget there. And I like that, as you point out, people still have this kind of conspiratorial mindset of, well, maybe the third prophecy wasn't really released. And again, you kind of get this idea set up through Petrucca's run of, yeah, like the thing about conspiracies is that they are often fundamentally unprovable and unverifiable. And like, that's an interesting paradox with a show like The X-Files, where you can't necessarily prove any of this crazy stuff. That's why it's so fundamental. That's how it's so fundamentally crazy. And I think Petrucca is onto that from the outset.
Yeah. And I like that Mulder's immediate sort of go-to in this comic is, well, maybe the prophecy is saying that angels are aliens. Like, yeah. and it's great because it's like you say, the show, more so after this kind of period, really leans into the fact that the only thing Mulder doesn't believe in is God, essentially.
Yeah. And I like that Petrucca has that read on him immediately, where it's like, yeah, it's not God, it's aliens.
Yeah, exactly. And they haven't gone too heavily yet into the that moment. The religious episodes always being the ones where Scully is the believer, you know, that kind of thing. But there are definite seeds of that here. There's that welding together. And it's done, I suppose, in a different way to how Carter does it, which is a bit more abstract. This is actually putting in the Vatican secret archives, and you know, which is almost like Doctor Who stuff in some senses, but it does work that Mulder would have an interest in this. And you've got these conspirators, you know, working with you know, crime villains and all these kind of things, trying to cover up and trying to make sure this prophecy stays secret, you know, before it gets released.
That's an interesting thing about this, and it's something that I think it takes Petrucca a little while to work out. I don't think, not to be opened until Xmas gets it entirely right, but there's a sense of, so when this is welcome to Darren's grand theory of like supplementary media and tie-in media, but like I my general philosophy is that there are two kinds of tie-in media. And this is a gross generalization, and it's not a fully formed theory. I look forward to listeners letting me know what they think of it. But generally, two schools of thought when it comes to tie-in media. And the first one is, I want tie-in media that just recreates what the original media was for me, that just replays it, takes characters, slots them into formulaic plots, follows a similar structure, and delivers exactly what I get from the source material. And the other one is, actually, I like tie-in media that takes those elements of the source material and does things with them that the source material never could for a variety of reasons, whether because it's a shift in the format, whether because of budgetary constraints, whether because that original media was a subject of its time. And so, you know, I mean, to pick examples, you could argue that a lot of modern media is arguably fan fiction because it's largely written by people who came up loving the original iterations of franchises that they are now running. So think of Star Wars. And I would think that, say, The Force Awakens is a good example of the kind of first strain of fandom that I talked about, or kind of like tie-in media, where it's like, it's the original Star Wars. It's A New Hope. We just slot in new characters, but the plot is largely the same. We bring back the Millennium Falcon. We have all the things that you recognize arranged in a configuration that is instantly recognizable to any viewer of Star Wars. And then I would argue that The Last Jedi is the second configuration of tie-in media, which is like, yeah, but that was 1977 and this is 2017. So we have to realize and reckon with what these archetypes mean today. And one of the things that I really love about Petrucca's run, and I don't think it works entirely in this issue, but I think it starts clicking into place literally with the next one, is his understanding that he is writing a comic book, and a comic book is a fundamentally different medium than a television show. And I mean that in a number of ways. So pick, for example, and again, sorry, this is I worry this is going to be Darren's annotations of the X-Files comic. But if you take, for example, like the opening first page of like the X-Files comic book, of like issue number one, you have the idea, the opening dialogue box talks about the idea, you know, the one true world is God's book. Do you realize what that means? I have read creation, all else is false. And it's like, is reality a book? Yes, it is, because I'm holding the book that contains this reality in my hand and I'm reading it. But not only that, within the comic book compositions that you have from like Charles Adlard, and Adlard is a fantastic artist. We'll probably talk a bit more about him later on when we talk about the difference between him and, say, Gordon Purcell. But the thing about Adlard is, and Adlard is famous for being one of the co-creators with Robert Kirkham of The Walking Dead, and so will never have to work again in his life. But you have, like, in that opening page, if you look at how Adlard structures the panels, he has like a variety of crisscross grids on them. So you have like the silhouette of the priest in the confession booth. You have the kind of checker box kind of pattern on the floor. And you have this idea of kind of boxes, which are all very much laid out like comic book panels. This is a comic book that is telling you that it is a comic book. It's telling you that you are reading things contained in boxes and panels even before you are. And if you want to talk about, like, you talked about how, like, Petrucca goes all in and it's like the Vatican is conspiring with the military, is conspiring with organized criminals, and there's literally a subplot about smuggling plutonium, like, in this, like, single issue comic as well. Petrucca understands that he's working in a medium that is pulpier, kind of trashier, broader and larger than like television can be. And so he pitches the stories that he tells in that fashion. And when I said, I don't think he gets the balance entirely right, not to jump too far ahead, but there's a moment at the end of the first issue where Scully shoots down a UFO with her hand pistol. And that is not something that would ever happen on the X-Files on television. It's something that feels like very comic booky in the sense of, well, you know, you have an unlimited budget because like it costs as much to have Charles Adlard illustrate like a priest sitting in a confession booth as it does to have him illustrate Scully blowing up a UFO. But I don't think it gets the balance quite right yet. But you can already see the Petrucca's going like, this is a comic book. This needs to be a comic book. It can't just be a reiteration or a retread of the TV show. I can't just do what Carter is doing week in and week out on the TV show, because I'll never be able to do it as well as him. I'll never be able to do it as frequently as him, because I can only do 24 pages a month as opposed to 4 whole episodes a month. And I'm never going to be part of what he's doing, because that's not a priority for him, understandably. So I like that Petrucca goes, no, this is a comic book, and this is kind of what we're going to do. We're going to stick with the format of a comic book. And not to like spoil or kind of cast too many aspersions, or sorry, like hint too much at kind of what's going ahead or kind of give up too many spoilers, the opening dialogue here and the opening scene here and the structure and the rhythm of it, Petrucca may or may not, Darren says coyly, return to that towards the end of his first year on the comic. And it's the kind of thing that you can only do in a comic book because television at the time was, again, ironically seen as being a disposable medium. Like, we've talked on the podcast before about how, as an X-Files fan, it was very hard to watch the show if you didn't catch it on Friday nights. You had to have fan groups where people would, like, record off television and mail VHS copies to one another. You know, we talked about how, I think, like, when Fox did get around to releasing VHSs, that I think they released up until Ice, and then they're like, screw it, we'll just release the mythology episodes because those are the popular ones on VHS anyway. But with comic books, if you paid, you know, if you paid your $2.50 for this comic book, you got to keep it and you got to hold it and you got to read it as many times as you wanted. So when you bought issue 1 through 12 and you got to issue 12 of the comic, you could flick back to issue 1 and go, yeah, that's the same scene. That's the same dialogue. That's a kind of like a very prominent echo of something that he did a year ago. But I can hold the two pages in my hand and go, yeah, this is what he was doing. And it's not something that I think you could get away with doing on television at the time. I mean, we talk about The X-Files as a show that really pioneered kind of like primetime serialization in the 90s. But even then, you know, it didn't go fully serialized until about like season 8. You know, it didn't assume that you'd watched every episode of the show until you got to season 8. And season 8 arrived, like when we'll be talking about on The X-Cast, at the time where DVD collections were becoming popular and accessible, which meant that you could do what we talked about with comics with TV shows. You could, like, watch the entire season on a disc. You could go back and watch it again. You could watch episode, you know, 22 and episode 1 back-to-back if you wanted and compare the shots in them and so see the parallels and follow the arcs. But, like, in 1995, that was not something that you could do with the show. That was not something you could do on television. And Petrucca, I think, to his credit, understands that writing a comic book is different from writing a show, and he leans into it. And I think, like, you know, I think Not to Be Open Until Xmas isn't one of his best stories, but I think it's an important one. And I think the problem with it is that he's still figuring it out. He's still kind of figuring out what the balance is between what The X-Files looks like on TV and what The X-Files looks like in comic form.
A good example of this is, in a different way, is the moment that did make me laugh, actually, where Scully is doing the autopsy on the John Doe, and this his woman turns up with her daughter and says, "Oh, well, she wants to be healed by touching his body." And Scully's like,
"Yeah, sure,
I'll leave the door open for you. It's fine. You go in." And then it turns out that they're here to nick the body, and she's like, "They took the body molder." It's like that. She would look so stupid on television.
Yeah, no,
It gets away with it, I think, you know, just about. It's still ridiculous, but because it's a comic, it's a decent shorthand for getting them to where they need to be. But on TV, you would never in a million years write that moment, really.
Yeah. Oh, you'd never forgive it. It would be one of like the most infamous moments in X-Files history, where Scully went out. I think she goes out to a vending machine to get a Coke and comes back and finds the body stolen. And like, it is. Like, it's a moment that even in the comic, you're like, this is a bit... I understand that you need to bridge that narrative, and I understand you only have 24 pages, but come on, there has to have been a better way of doing that.
It is still a bit hokey. And so like you say, that he's still finding his feet, he's still learning. It's a decent opening story. It establishes... It has that nice blend of historical mythology. Things like... how one of the prophecies corresponds to the genuine event of an aurora borealis at the start of 1938, which lit up a lot of the world, particularly Europe. And the prophecy sort of suggested there would be a bright light before God punishing, you know, the wicked for their crimes. And then there's the Second World War breaking out, things like that. So it's not quite nice the way it does that. It tries to tie those little things together. And like you say, it has quite openly funny moments of Scully shooting down what could be a government UFO and actually an aliens UFO. But either way, it's quite fun.
And I mean, you're also like, there's a moment with like the cigarette smoking man and Skinner where you can tell that like Petrucca, because like literally the only episode with Skinner and the cigarette smoking man in it to this point was like Tombs. You have lines like the cigarette smoking man saying, "You're off the case. Go chase Bigfoot!" Exclamation marks. And you have like Skinner like in like prime like police chief mode going, "Damn it, man, we're trying to keep you alive." It's very hard to reconcile those characters with the versions who appeared in the show outside of understanding the context in which this was written, you know?
Skinner also looks really old as well. It's like the back of his hair is grey. I'm like, come on, give Mitch Pileggi some slack here. But it's a fun opener and it sets the stall nicely. I would say that the next two issues, Disremembrance of Things Past and A Little Dream of Me, are a stronger two-parter. Because they are quite unnerving at points, actually. And they are quite strange and esoteric. And they are obviously tapping into ufology and mythology and that kind of thing. But there is also, because it's such a focus on memory and dreams, it has a strange aura to it, this one.
Yes, I mean, like, I'm on record saying that, like, A Disremembrance of Things Past is one of my favorite X-Files things ever. Like, it's one of my favorite X-Files-related stories ever told. I talked about the X-Files, this comic being one of my favorite pieces of X-Files lore. It was this, because I remember reading, like, you know, I read Not to Be Open with Xmas. I was like, it's fine. It's a tie-in comic book. You know, what you're going to do? It's got some interesting ideas. It's a bit rough around the edges. And Scully shoots down a UFO, you know? It's grand. And then I read A Dismemberance of Things Past, and I read it immediately again. And I was like, is this possibly the best X-Files thing ever written? Which is quite something to come away from on your first read. It is masterful. And it's the point at which, like, I think Not to Be Open Until Xmas was, like, Petrucca saying, look, I can write an X-Files comic. I can do this. I can write a monthly X-Files comic. It's going to work functionally. It will be fine. But I feel like A Dismemberance of Things Past is Petrucca going, yeah, but this is my X-Files comic. This is what my version of the X-Files will look like, because it's the point at which it really starts hammering down what the next 10 issues and change are going to be about for the comic, in a way that doesn't necessarily feel heavy-handed. It's a self-contained story. It has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a resolution, and it has its own little elements that all fit together. But it's very much like, if you're paying attention here, it's like, I think I get what this is about in a big sense, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, completely. Essentially, the story revolves around a supposed Roswell-like UFO crash in Neola, Kansas, that happened in 1948, that Mulder and Scully are sort of pulled towards when he gets a visit from very, very Men in Black-style military men in the middle of the night, while he's having some quite sort of moments of dreaming while there's things on the television. And they go down there and they meet a supposed one of the few, because it's after one of the survivors has been murdered, been shot dead, and they go down there and they meet a general who was involved, who seems to be quite decrepit at this point and won't give them much information. But then they go and meet an old lady called Meg, who is one of the survivors of this UFO crash, and she remembers it happening. She remembers seeing an alien body and all these kind of things. But then what happens slowly throughout the story is that it becomes a comment on memory and on whether or not this ever actually happened. And as it turns out, as we then get in the second part, it is far more about a conspiracy involving a memory altering compounds that have essentially created a false implanted memory in the minds of these people. A compound that then starts to affect Scully and it starts to affect Mulder. And it's a very, very interesting story, because it does that. What you do get in some X-Files stories later on, particularly things like, reminded me a little bit of Unusual Suspects, actually, that comes later. That kind of idea that you start going down one path and then maybe you veer onto another. And I think I really like the fact that it is quite strange. It is weird in many ways. It doesn't do what you think the story's going to do. You think it's going to be about investigating a UFO crash, which is, you know, bog standard kind of X-Files fare. But then it becomes quite dark and actually quite scary. And I really like, particularly this first part. The second part is a little bit more conspiracy, I guess, really. A little bit more, of a thriller, which is fine. And then it gets into the Samantha stuff, which we will talk about, which is all very interesting. But I prefer the first part, the one you love particularly, because I think it is quite haunting as a comic, as a story.
I mean, again, we should probably put some quick context in this. I apologize. Future episodes will be quicker, I promise, listeners. We talked about
that's fine.
We talked about why the X-Files comic happened in a business sense, like a moment ago, in terms of like just Topps getting into comic book publishing and wanting to license material and like the collector's market and speculations boom. But why does the X-Files comic look the way that it does? Why is it about the things that it's about? And I talked to Petrucca about this. I talked to Stefan Petrucca about this. And again, as somebody who was a teenager when he got into comics, and in particular kind of a teenager towards the end of the 90s when he got into comics, you saw a shift in kind of what comic books were about and the stories that like mainstream American comic books were telling towards the end of the 80s. And again, like very high level notes, you know, the publication of Watchmen is probably a big one. The publication of The Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller is another one as well, where you have this idea that comic books are no longer just things for kids, but can be read by like teenagers and by adults. And particularly like the arrival of Alan Moore, who writes comics like Watchmen. He writes comics like the Captain Britain for Marvel. He writes comics like V for Vendetta. He writes comics like that run on Swamp Thing as well. And basically, Karen Berger, an editor at DC, says, well, actually, this is a unique voice. American comics has never had anything like this. And she goes over and she recruits a whole bunch of like British countercultural writers from like late 80s, kind of like working class backgrounds, and says, actually, would you like to come over to America and write comic books for DC? And some of them will be superhero books, but some of them won't be. And some of them will be written as part of this kind of imprint that DC is going to publish called Vertigo. And among them, you have writers like, say, Neil Gaiman, who is now a famous writer in his own right, you know, thanks to things like American Gods, for example. He comes over and he does Sandman, which is currently going to be adapted by Netflix, and is like a foundational text. If you're looking to get into comic books and you're not into superheroes, Sandman is probably about as good as it gets. But she also hires like writers like, say, Warren Ellis, who is currently disgraced and deservedly so for various things, but he writes things like Metropolitan. She would later go on and recruit like writers like Garth Ennis from Northern Ireland, who would write things like Preacher, which is now obviously a hit TV show produced by Seth Rogen, and he also did The Boys later on, which is also another hit TV show produced by Seth Rogen. And she, you know, and then you also get people like, say, Mark Millar, who's brought in by Grant Morrison, who, you know, is responsible for things like, say, Kick-Ass or Wanted or Jupiter's Legacy on Netflix as well. But yeah, people like Grant Morrison, people like Peter Milligan start writing these comic books, and they're aimed at a slightly older audience than conventional superhero fare. They're a little bit weirder. They're a little bit more obscure. They're a little bit more metafictional and self-aware. So like Grant Morrison is probably the big one here, because you have like Alan Moore come in and write Watchmen, and he decides he's done with superheroes. But Grant Morrison is like, no, I want to be part of the mainstream. And he writes books that are like, say, Animal Man or Doom Patrol, which are comic books that are, to a certain extent, about being comic books, and in particular about like the weird internal logic of comic books. So, you know, Animal Man has a final issue where Animal Man visits the real world and confronts a writer called Grant Morrison, who is ruining his life because he's writing stupid superhero adventures for him and turning him into a tragedy. And you have like this kind of idea of like reality bending and how reality fits into itself, and the kind of notions of how we think about the world. I think, like, to pick a famous example, the Matrix movie back in 1999 by the Wachowskis is very heavily influenced by Morrison's work on books like, say, The Invisibles or The Filth, which are published at Vertigo. And reading these X-Files comics, you get a real sense of that, because one of their big recurring themes is that question of what is real and what is real beyond an individual's perception of what is real. And you mentioned the theme of memory as well, because one of the big things that comes up in A Dismemberance of Things Past is the question of, if you remember something, does that make it real even if it never actually happened? And what happens if you take away an individual's memory? Is that equivalent to erasing their identity? And does it detach them from reality? Can reality exist without memory? And do those things, how do those objects relate to one another? And, you know, again, this is something where Petrucca has looked at the show, like the show, and particularly like the first season of the show, where you have things like Conduit, where Mulder has this memory of Samantha being abducted, and he has this repressed memory that he discovers, and it completely changes his life. It completely changes who he is. He goes from being like the bright star of the kind of violent crimes unit to the freaky guy who lives in the basement chasing little green men, all because of this thing that he remembered under the influence of hypnosis. And so how does he know that that's real? How does he know that that's true? And the show, you know, touches on that obliquely in a couple of ways, but it never really kind of delves into it. Watching the show, there's never a moment where you as an audience member think, ha, maybe Samantha wasn't abducted by aliens. Like, even when the show eventually reveals what happened to her, part of the really convoluted backstory is, yes, turns out she was abducted by aliens, but a whole bunch of other stuff happened as well. Like, that that foundational idea is never entirely kind of challenged. Whereas with Petrucca's run on the X-Files comic, you have him play with that idea of, well, what if something you remember didn't happen? And what if that was such a core part of who you are, that it was part of your identity and part of what made you who you are and a cornerstone of how you see yourself? How would you feel if you discovered that memory was fake, it never happened? Would that change who you are? Would that change your perception of reality? And would you be the person that you thought you were when you had that memory? And it's, and you know, it all sounds very college dorm room, pass the bong at 3 a.m. in the morning. But it's a, I think it's a really genuinely affecting approach to this. And I think, again, at the risk of being kind of like wanky and kind of, you know, overly celebratory and being kind of like, oh, look how self-aware it is. In the third issue of the comic, A Little Dream of Me, which I've always assumed is a shout out to Neil Gaiman's work on Sandman as part of that wave of the British invasion, because obviously the, you know, the Sandman is the Lord of Dreams, and I think one of his early comic issues is titled Little Dream of Me. But in that issue, you have a wonderful touch where Petrucca has Mulder say, sometimes I remember it one way and sometimes I remember it another way. Sometimes I'm standing up, sometimes I'm sitting down. And that is an acknowledgement of a continuity error that exists within the show versus like the version of the account of Samantha's abduction that he provides in Conduit versus the one that the audience actually saw in the second season premiere, Little Green Men. And instead of Petrucca going, no, don't worry, but that's just a continuity error. Don't worry about it. It's not a problem. Just go with it. Just assume that it happened the latest way that you saw. Instead, Petrucca does something which is very clever, I think, and goes, but what if Mulder did actually remember this event two different ways? Does that imply that maybe his memory isn't entirely perfect?
And he's ahead of his time there as well, in the sense that when you get things like Paper Hearts or particularly Demons in season 4, it's all about that kind of, it's all about going back to that moment and replaying it, and Mulder not being sure quite what happened, whether it's the John Lee Roach, you know, being the one who kidnapped and killed her, or then in Demons where he's seen all these fragments when he has the temporal lobe kind of thing go on. All those kind of things very much start exploring whether Mulder's memory of all that. And then you've got the Dr. Hite's Verba stuff, yes. and you know, and all that. And it's definitely there in the show. And so Petrucca's getting ahead of the curve there slightly. And I love that. I love the fact that it is putting those different spins on those accounts that don't tie up, because that's far more realistic in something like this, isn't it? You know, that kind of trauma that he experienced as a child, and not just a trauma, but also something strange and in theory beyond belief. I mean,
and something that was buried as well. Like, I mean, like again, like right. it's worth noting that like Glenn Morgan and James Wong, the writers who did Little Green Men, and like some of the formative writers when it comes to like X-Files mythology in terms of like the core of the characters, like one of their core preoccupations in writing, like in the 90s, in writing on the X-Files and writing on Millennium, were things like the McMartin preschool scandal, the satanic ritual abuse stuff, all of which, like, it's a huge part, for example, in Dehan DeVerlitz, their last script on the X-Files. It's a big part of Monster in the second season of Millennium, for example. It's arguably even there in, say, The Field Where I Died in the fourth season, the hugely controversial one about past lives. But this idea that, like, in the 90s you had this idea of satanic ritual abuse, where a bunch of children remembered being abused and remembered being like tortured and remembered being assaulted by Satan worshippers. And it was this huge wave that was incredibly popular, where like people were subjecting kids to these regression hypnosis techniques. And a lot of that stuff turned out to be false. It turned out to be a result of like improper like procedures, basically. And a lot of it turned out to be falsifiable. And so you have this question of like this huge trauma that never actually happened. And like the question of like, if this thing never happened, obviously they weren't tortured by Satan worshippers, but if they remember being tortured by Satan worshippers, what does that mean? Because they live with that memory now. That is part of them and their identity. And I think like Petrucca, and again, this is where we mentioned like the difficulties that Petrucca faces when he tries to fold his comics into the X-Files mythology in the previous episode, in the previous story, where he has like Skinner say, "Damn it, man, we're trying to keep you alive." But I think like with dismemberance of things past, you start seeing Petrucca figure out what he can do, which is look at something from the show that the show hasn't picked up and run with, and run with it in his own direction. So that, like, you know, you're right that the show does come back to these themes in episodes like Demons, like Paper Hearts. You point to the Darren Morgan episodes as well. Like, I mean, I think there's a lot of Darren Morgan here. There's a lot of Jose Chung here, for example, as well. But, like, he runs with it in a way that is undeniably his, if that makes sense. And he, he owns it. This is something that is his, that he can play with in a way that will pay off for him without having to worry about the larger show. And again, it gives him a get out of jail free card, because like from now on, if anything in the comic is contradicted by anything on screen, he can just say, "Oh, you misremembered that because of post-hypnotic suggestion. Don't worry about it." Which, you know, is like in terms of like a practical writer's fix, is quite a clever one. But it's also one that is tied to a theme that is surprisingly affecting. I find this comic really moving, like really strangely kind of like sad and affecting, because you have this entire generation of this town that has built its identity around an event that never happened. And again, like at the risk of like making this like, you know, kind of blowing the trumpet for this a little bit too much, I love that, like, when I opened it and when I first read it, I was like, the Neola, Kansas incident? I'm not familiar with that. And you have, like, Mulder saying, yeah, it was the second most popular UFO sighting after Roswell. It was a massive event. People, you know, like, people couldn't stop talking about it. I'm like, I have never heard of this. Never happened. I did a quick Google and it's like, Neola, Kansas exists, but there's nothing about a UFO there. And I kind of love that the comic by its nature then like plays a, it's a trick on you as an audience member, because like, oh, by the way, the reason why like it's not referring to a real event is because there was no real event.
There was no event.
Yeah. It's not like the Fatima prophecies in the last issue, you know, or the kind of like Roswell incident. It never happened. It's like the Fargo thing, where it's like, this is based on a true story, even though none of it is. Which again, like that milieu of kind of mid-90s postmodernism, where we have no idea what's real, which will obviously then later on give way to things like, you know, The Matrix, or kind of The 13th Floor, or Carter's own Harsh Realm. So again, like, I think all of it's dialed into all of this, which I find like fascinating.
Yeah, it's done so well. And I think over these two issues, it doesn't lose sight of that. It doesn't lose sight of this overarching idea of memory, and then it does what I think a good X-Files two-parter does, in that it starts with something quite fairly, in terms of X-Files, ordinary and distant from Mulder and Scully, and then it deepens it and it personalizes it. So by the end, you have Mulder starting to wonder about Samantha, and you have that wonderful final moment where they've figured out that all of the, because this guy Dunn, the guy who is the insider who ends up
Dunn,
who says, "I can give you your sister back." You know, he's one of the many people who can give you your sister back. And then he gets lots of images that seem to show Samantha at different ages and this kind of thing. And Scully debunks all of them. And she says, "Oh, no, they're all actresses. They're all this kind of thing." But there's one image that Mulder can't debunk. He can't find the source of. And it is of a young Samantha. And it's that lovely moment. The idea at the end is that it gives him a little bit of hope. Because there is still the possibility that she's out there. Because he can't quite... It could be her. It could be the real Samantha. And that's a great little moment. Because what Petrucca's doing is he's not conclusively giving any answers. He's not putting anything into continuity that has to be fixed. But at the same time, it adds an extra depth and dimension to the characters that we know on screen. And this does... It can fit, for the most part. It could fit within the grand tapestry. And it would be okay, you know? And that's what I think is really good, particularly about this story. And I hope that, and I don't know, you will know this, Darren, but I don't know at this stage, I hope that is a trend that continues throughout the run of Petrucca's, run on the comics.
Well, I mean, in terms of, like, the second part of the story, in terms of things like A Little Dream of Me, you start seeing, like, it feels very much like Petrucca's realizing and grappling with the fact that the mythology toys are not his. I think this is, like, not to spoil it for readers or for yourself, this is one of the last times that we see the cigarette-smoking man quite a while, because he's taken off the table and Petrucca's told, you can't use this guy. And you also have, and again, this is something I find interesting, and it's something that kind of prefigures a lot of what I love about the second season of Millennium, ironically enough. But you mentioned that idea of doubt and the idea of there being something that Mulder cannot debunk or disprove. That kind of, you know, the splinter in his mind is probably the best way to describe it. The thing that is unknowable, and it's like, it's terrifying because it's unknowable. That's what makes it so scary and so haunting. You start seeing with A Dream of Me, Petrucca saying, okay, the conspiracy that I'm dealing with here, because I am dealing with a conspiracy. Back in the first issue, you have like a man in a general's uniform meeting the Vatican and talking about how, oh, we've always gotten on very well with each other. We understand how this works. And you have the mentioning of the name Aquarius, which may or may not become an arc word as we go on. But with A Dream of Me, you start seeing the idea that there's not just one conspiracy. There's not just one grand overarching mythology. There's a separate one, because Dunn wants himself erased from the records of the Pentagon. That's what he's manipulating Mulder to do. He wants him to destroy the data and the proof that he exists. And again, that idea of, like, if he's no longer in the records, does he exist? If he's no longer in official memory, does he really exist? But you have Petrucca basically realizing that because he can't play with the mythology of the show, he can't build off, you know, like, Ascension and Dwayne Barry. He can't build off the Erlenmeyer flask. And, like, notably here, you have a moment where Mulder, like, is searching through the documents for details about Samantha, and he finds a whole drawer full of what look like alien fetuses, what look like the contents of the Erlenmeyer flask, and one of them shatters and breaks on the ground in a moment that really feels like Petrucca going, yeah, no, I know I can't use that. That's not my toy. I can't play with that one. But so you have this idea that actually there's another conspiracy out there. And one of the things I really admire about the comic is that it captures the sense in which conspiracy theories are, despite the fact they initially seem like ordering principles on the world and that they explain how things work, they explain why the world is the way that it is, if you start pulling at them and you start exploring them, they become mazes and spirals and circles of themselves that you get lost in, and they intersect and overlap in ways that kind of contradict one another. You know, there's a famous, I think, statistic about how if you believe one conspiracy theory, you are statistically more likely to believe any other conspiracy theory, including one that directly contradicts the one that you believe. And like, with things past, you have, again, Petrucca doing a clever thing of realizing that his continuity is going to contradict the continuity of the show, but turning it into a thematic point where it's like, no, no, there's not just one conspiracy. It's not just the old cigarette-smoking man. There's another secret cabal that is doing a whole bunch of other secret stuff. And that secret stuff is completely unrelated, but also intersecting with the secret stuff that you know about. And have you gone cross-eyed yet? I kind of hope that you have. Because that gets the sense in which this stuff is, as you point out, more terrifying, more unsettling, because it's not knowable. Like, the thing with the X-Files TV show, and we talk about this when we talk about the mythology, is, like, for all that people talk about how Carter didn't have it figured out beforehand, and how he didn't map it out, a lot of it fits together. And, like, a large part of, like, a solid hour of The Truth as an episode of television is Carter basically sitting you down as an audience member, and so going, see? See, it all makes sense. Look at how it all fits together. I knew exactly what I was doing. Now pay attention to the clip show as I have characters explain it to you. And like, there is one overarching conspiracy that ties it all together. Whereas with the comic book, you start to see, no, it's not that neat. It's never that easy. And somehow it's scarier because it's not that, because all the pieces don't fit. It's that photo that you mentioned, the photo that Mulder can't place. Like, I like that that becomes a metaphor for the space in which Petrucca's playing, because the comic book is a piece of X-Files continuity that you can't place, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Yeah, it's a great way to sum that up, really. And that's going to be the fun of going through these comics, I think. I think, and finding discussing the stories within, finding the themes, picking out where they fit. And I think the key really is feeling like something that isn't canonical has value, because I think this is more and more the case, you know, and I particularly love all the non-canonical Star Trek stuff as a big fan of that franchise, or, you know, reading things like James Bond, all this kind of stuff. I think so often people might write off, I mean, I would be interested to see, and I might in fact put a poll up in the XCast basement, but how many people have read these? How many of the mega fans that we interact with so often have actually read any of this stuff? Whether they're a comic book fan or not, I would venture that it's probably fairly few. And that's because I think tie-in media for a long time has been seen as quite disposable. And I think this kind of work, when it's this good, when it's written this well, when it's drawn this beautifully, is really worth seeking out and reading. Even though it is, as you say, a separate conspiracy, a separate continuity almost in a way, or not something that is official, it doesn't make it any less worthy. And I think there are already, I agree, I think that the Disremembrance of Things Past is this excellent X-Files story, and it just happens to be in a different medium. And I think that's the beauty of discovering all of these things that have been there for a long time, but not everyone will have read.
I mean, that's kind of, like, interesting, not to, like, chart too much of an arc. I don't know how far we're going to go with these comics. We've said we're going to do all of them. I am happy to do all of them. I'm really looking forward to doing all of them. I don't know if we will get to things like the entire IDW line or how long it's going to take us to get there. So I don't feel too bad about, like...
Forever, Darren.
For as long as it takes Forever. Is the answer.
Alfred Fellig. We'll be doing it in 150 years.
Yeah. I don't feel too bad about, like, just kind of, like, pulling back the baseball bat, asking you to pull back the ball and just throw it at me so I can hit it and see where it lands. But I think one of the big interesting arcs of, like, the X-Files tie-in comic book line in particular is its relationship to the continuity of the show and how essential it feels and what that says about our relationship to comic book media. And particularly our relationship to tie-in media. Because you mentioned one of the big things about modern media is the canon and continuity and how something fits. And it's not just the X-Files, obviously. There's a larger cultural conversation to be had about it. You look at things like, say, this run that we have here, which is its own animal and its own themes and its own kind of idea. And even like the art that is done by Charles Adlard. The art by Charles Adlard was usually controversial to 1013 because he doesn't do good celebrity likenesses. He's an artist who works very well with mood and expression. You understand what the characters are feeling and you understand the pervasive mood of the scene. Like, he you have like the wonderful inking and the use of black space and negative space, which is like exactly what you want from an X-Files comic, because that was like the cinematography of the TV show. It was this kind of very atmospheric, very kind of heavy, very dark, very shadowy show. And Adlard captures that perfectly, but he doesn't always draw Mulder and Scully so they look like David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And like one of the big things that you see later on, and again, not to jump too far ahead, is you see like 1013 insisting, no, bring in like Gordon Purcell, who is an artist who is like very strong in his own right, but who does really great likenesses, and have him draw Mulder and Scully, because the Mulder and Scully in the comic should look like David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. That's the priority, not the mood, not the atmosphere, not the rich blacks. And then you get to things like, say, you know, we fast forward to the release of the comics tying into I Want to Believe, where it's like, okay, fine, we want fans to know this is important, so we're gonna hire Frank Spotnitz, because Frank Spotnitz is a name associated with the show, so fans will know that this comic is important because it's written by one of the guiding lights of the show, and he writes a story that is set back during the fifth season, and it's like, oh, it takes elements from like Redux 1 and Redux 2, which are fan beloved episodes, so it's like, yeah, no, this is important, it's real, and it has this voice of authorial confidence. It is like closer to the canon than those Topps comics were. Don't forget about those Topps comics. And then you jump forward another 10 years, roughly, and you end up with the IDW comics. And again, you know, we're going to talk about those in time, but a huge selling point, and it happened recently enough that people will remember this. A huge selling point for the IDW comics, at least originally when they were announced, was that these were going to be the official in-continuity canon continuation of the X-Files. Carter had given it his blessing and had said, yes, this comic that you are going to read is the story of what happens to Mulder and Scully after I Want to Believe. It's all true, all of it. And it matters, and it has weight. And then, of course, like, you end up with a situation where Fox greenlight the X-Files revival, and Carter's like, oh, nope, never mind, forget that, comic's out of continuity again, never mind, it's just a supplementary thing. But you have this kind of, like, idea that it matters, and that, like, the IDW comics are real. The same thing that you see with, say, like, the Buffy comics, where they're published, like, season 8, season 9, season 10, published by, like, Dark Horse with Josh Whedon, saying, no, this is officially the continuity, this is in-continuity continuation of the comics, of the, like, TV show that you loved. Or the Star Wars comics, which are currently published by Marvel, which are owned by Disney, who own Lucasfilm, and who are saying, no, these are now officially part of the canon. They matter. You're going to see characters here that will turn up in the movies later, so that you won't feel like you've, you know, in inverted commas, wasted your time by reading this material. And I think, like, that's one of the interesting tensions going back and looking at this Topps run, because Petrucca understands that he's never going to be canon. He understands that his run is never going to be like an essential part of the what defines the X-Files. Nobody is ever going to mention the Aquarius conspiracy on film. And he realizes that, but then manages to turn that, rather than making it a bug or a problem or something that he struggles against or something that he is embarrassed of or ashamed of, he turns it into a feature of the comic. And I find that kind of fascinating. That's what I love about this. And again, you mentioned like Star Trek and you mentioned the non-canon novels. Like, one of the things that I think people... And again, sorry, this is a very long episode and I apologize to listeners already, but I think it's an interesting discussion about canon and continuity.
Yeah.
When Star Trek went off the air in 1969, everybody assumed that it was dead and it was not coming back. It might be an animated TV show, but, you know, people were already so embarrassed by the animated TV show that you had, like, Richard Arnold say, no, it's not canon. And Gene Roddenberry say, no, it's not canon. And ironically, eventually, like, later on, as kids who had grown up watching the animated TV show kind of, like, came to work on Star Trek, they're like, maybe it's canon. Let's bring a little bit of it back in because we loved it so much. But there was this period in the 70s where Star Trek was seen as being a dead property. It was done. It was dusted. There was no real future seen for it. And you had these books that were being published first by Bantam and then by Pocket Books. And you had these fans who had grown up with the show writing these books with an understanding that it didn't matter whether they were canon or continuity. It didn't matter that they, you know, might contradict some future iteration of the show. It was just things that they loved about the show and brought to the fore. So things like Sulu's first name comes from, I think, Vonda N. McIntyre's The Entropy Effect. I think Nyota Uhura only got her first name in Uhura's song. I'm not entirely sure about that last one. But, like, these things that we come to see as being foundational for the characters and, like, inform generations of people who work on the franchise afterwards. Things like, say, John M. Ford's the book he wrote, what was it, the one about the Klingons, The Final Reflection, which is not continuity at all. It was completely thrown out and rewritten when Ronald D. Moore actually got to, like, characterizing the Klingons on Star Trek The Next Generation. But, like, when that book was published, it was hugely influential to an entire generation of fans and creators who said, actually, this is a really interesting way of looking at these characters, even though it's not in continuity and it's not canon. And so you have people, like, filling in the gaps and kind of, like, trying to branch off and do interesting things with the property. And, like, this is my personal preference when it comes to this fan material. I don't need an X-Files comic that supplements my TV show. I don't need an X-Files comic that is offering an imitation of, you know, the 200 episodes that I own on Blu-ray, because if I want to watch more X-Files, I'll just pop in the Blu-ray. If I want, like, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, I will just watch an episode of the X-Files starring David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. When I pick up an X-Files comic, I want something that is different from an X-Files episode on television. I want something that does something unique to the medium that it's operating in and the conventions in which it's operating, and takes advantage of the opportunities that exist in this medium that don't exist within the confines of a network TV show airing weekly on Fox. And, like, that's the thing that you mentioned, the kind of push and pull, where, like, this doesn't matter, in inverted commas, as much as, you know, any tie-in media matters. None of this is ever going to come back in any meaningful way, but I find something strangely liberating in that. I think that there's a freedom that this enjoys because it's aware of that fact, you know, if that makes sense. And I kind of, I've always, like, as a fan, like, that's what's always drawn me to these projects, or these kind of, like, these elements, or these little corners of, like, continuity and minutiae, is, like, I don't want you to try and, like, offer a pale imitation of something that the show is doing brilliantly week in and week out. I want you to take some of the ideas of the show and make them work in a way that they couldn't work on screen. And I think that, yeah, you know, with these comics, you see Petrucca and Adlard doing that. And I, like, as we go on, we'll see that, like, the reaction to that wasn't always, gee, this is fantastic. But I think that, like, I think it gets away with a lot.
And it's going to be really fun to delve into this and go through them. And we'll be back semi-regularly. It's not going to be, like, a weekly thing necessarily, but we will be covering them. So they're going to be worth the wait. It's going to be really fun, me getting to explore them. It's going to be great hearing Darren's fantastic analysis on them. For a shortcut, go and read, as I say, go and read his stuff. We'll put in the show notes about this, you know, his previous reviews. Yeah, this is going to be a great project to go through. It's going to be such fun. So until you do return for this and plenty of other X-Cast discussions, Darren, why don't you point the listeners to where they can find you and what you're up to.
All right, so since I don't know when people are going to be listening to this inside the time capsule, let's keep this as general and as vague as possible. You can find me at the movie blog with a zero instead of an O because I didn't register it quick enough. A quick Google, Darren Mooney movie blog, will find me there. I'm on Twitter at Darren_Mooney. I co-host a podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn, where we go through the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time, and sometimes some movies that aren't on that list either. If you are a Patreon listening, coming up, Tony will be joining us for a discussion of the four Indiana Jones movies,
yes,
as part of what we're calling our Indiana Summer. And if you are listening to this in the memory hole archive, you can just Google them and give them a quick find, and they'll be there as well. I also work at The Escapist, where I'm actually, like, a paid film critic, and I'm astounded that this is something that is happening, and I'm thrilled that it's happening, and still cannot believe that it's real. I'm waiting to discover that Tony has, like, dashed me with orange-smelling memory dust and convinced me that I am actually a film critic. But no, I'm available there. I do a bi-weekly movie podcast with the wonderful Jack Packard, and I do a bi-weekly video series in The Frame with the wonderful Omar Ahmed, where I look at a kind of a trope or a convention or a piece of popular fiction and explore why it works, why it doesn't work, what it means, and all that sort of stuff as well. And I occasionally publish film reviews and articles there as well. Just a quick Google, Darren Mooney Escapist, will bring all that stuff there. So I am absolutely everywhere. I am inescapable. I am inevitable, is where I am. And obviously, I'm here on the XCast as well, and I'm looking forward to coming back and discussing Firebird is the next one, isn't it?
Firebird, three parts. Yeah. I think the next one we'll do Firebird and we'll do Tree Panning Opera as well, which is
best title ever.
One after that. Yeah, very, very good. Very good title. So that's going to be a lot of fun to come. As always, guys, you can find me at AJ Black Writer on Twitter primarily, and you'll find all the links to what else is going on with me over there, including books and writing and podcasts and such. And obviously the We Made This Podcast Network at WNT_network, unless I change the username. Who knows? It's possible. But let's assume it's going to stay the way it is. WeMadeThisNetwork.com, where you can find the XCast and all the other things we've got going on. So yeah, check us out on all of those things. We'll be back in the not-too-distant future for more Topps Comics X-Files as we go through this series. It's going to be a blast. So until then, thanks for listening, guys. Stay safe and well. And remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Academy Watch.
I saw West Side Story actually the other day and I didn't really connect with it, so you know, some I like and some I won't, but generally I like the idea of a musical. Disney films, the animated Disney films, tend to enjoy them.
Of course. Are you a La La Land person? Because I was definitely a La La pet.
I hate La La Land. I just could not stand it.
Wow. We can't be friends anymore. I'm just going to, hang on. How do I turn this thing on?
Yeah. I've lost a lot of friends over this opinion, but I hate it.
Garfield is the best Spider-Man and La La Land is shit. Like, what?
I just like to be controversial.
We dig music.
But yeah, just missed out on my list this year. There was the Garbage record was great, so I got head off that.
Yeah, I was surprised that didn't end up on the main.
It was close.
I was surprised to not see it.
Wet Leg, who have released two songs so far. There's another one apparently coming out
terrible
later
band
this week.
Name.
Yeah, I can't get behind it. That's what our old history teacher was called, Mr. Wet Leg. It's actually Westlake, but like, apparently he pissed himself once.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a terrible band name, but they're great.
It's like if Wet Leg toured with pissed jeans. Can you imagine?
Right in the childhood.
When I was younger, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man looks way older than I was as a kid.
He looks older than you do now.
Way older than I am. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in the cartoons as well. Like in the cartoons, like the 90s one, he looked older. Mm. And that was the cartoon I watched when I was younger, was the 90s one. And we would have done that for this show. But as soon as Disney Plus came out, I binge watched it all. And then I encouraged you to watch it.
Yeah, and I've watched
and
it
then
as well.
And then we started the podcast.
And we were like, oh shit, we should have saved
that
it.
That should have been it. And then there was another one with Neil Patrick Harris in, which I probably did.
What, as in Doogie Howser MD?
Yeah, and, you know...
Ooh, I'm going to put that on my list.
A Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser MD.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network. The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This Podcast Network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.